Well, the New Hampshire primary is half over. John McCain has won the voting up there. A huge boost to his bid for the presidential nomination. Just months after his campaign was basically written off as a lost cause. So McCain is back. Strange fellow, that. I'll tell you, the other side of the ledger, well, it's McCain, Romney. Yeah, I'm sure most of you who care have already seen all this stuff, but just, yeah. Anyway, McCain wins. And on the other side, the Democrat side, it's Hillary neck and neck with Barack Obama. And I don't know if you have studied any of this, and I hope a lot of you haven't wasted much time on it, because it's a pretty ugly melodrama, a sideshow. It's kind of like one of those traveling freak shows, actually. It's not something we can take seriously. Ron Paul is the only man, and honestly, in my mature lifetime, at that level of politics, I have ever seen speak beside John Kennedy. But even Ron Paul speaks from his mind, maybe even and his heart, a little bit more than Kennedy had great speech writers. Ron Paul, as all of you have seen over and over again, speaks from his own inner self. And it's fascinating to see at that level of politics. Paul is polling now in New Hampshire 8%, which is no surprise to me, unfortunately. I wish I could be reporting other news. We've been through all this. We've talked about this for many months, all of you, and we're family. You know what's going on. So I thought what we'd do is spend a little time, our first hour tonight, with my friend and colleague of so many years, Peter Davenport, who is the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, and Peter's website, brilliant website, UFOcenter.com, is up there for you, which truly contains a national treasure, no pun on the movie, of information that our government should certainly be processing, gathering, collating, and giving to us. But, well, we know that game, too. But Peter is also a man of not insignificant past and present political acumen and expertise. And I think Peter Davenport is headed to a very prominent position in not too distant times to serve the people of Washington State. But we'll get into that in just a minute. And let's bring him on before he gets frostbitten out there. He's probably standing around shivering. What are you doing?
Yeah, it is cold up here, Jeff. We've got about 6 inches of new snow on the ground in eastern Washington, and it reminds me a great deal of my time in New Hampshire. Watching the results from that state make me a little bit nostalgic.
You were a kid, a New Hampshire kid. And,
yeah.
Yeah, sure. So tell us more.
I graduated from high school in Derry, New Hampshire, and places like Concord and Nashua and Exeter and Portsmouth were all my haunts back in the mid-1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I participated in a campaign for Nelson Rockefeller.
We won't hold that against you.
No,
you were young.
You
didn't know.
It was just about 44 years ago when Nelson Rockefeller was a candidate for the presidency, and he came to the town of Derry, New Hampshire, to speak, and he was introduced by the famous or infamous Sherman Adams, whose name you'll probably remember. You seem to be having the most amazing and eclectic collection of information of anyone I've seen. But,
well, eclectic, yes. Defective also. That's going back a long way, that name.
It is. It goes back to the Eisenhower administration, and Sherman Adams had to be dismissed by President Eisenhower because it was shown that Sherman Adams had received a vicuña skin coat, a coat made of South American animals. My, how far we've come since
the
mid-1950s. Yeah.
Oh, my. Oh.
So.
That's right. A coat. An alpaca coat.
Yeah.
That's a vicuña, is a small version of a llama.
Yeah.
Funny stuff. Way back then, and all right. So as a boy, you actually were there, and you saw, and you listened, and you didn't vote.
I was too young to vote even then. Even when I was in high school, well, then, when I was in high school, you had to be 21 to vote. It wasn't lowered to 18 until what, 1968 or 69, I think. Mm-hmm. And, I've talked to several people back in New Hampshire this afternoon and tonight to see what was going on there.
What did they say?
Well, the thing that I found remarkable and heartening is the throngs and throngs of young people who are back and who've gone to New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
I have a family member back there who traveled from San Francisco to New Hampshire in order to doorbell and assist the Ron Paul campaign.
That's great.
He tells me that there are hundreds and hundreds of dedicated young people who've been helping the Ron Paul campaign for many, many days now. And what they're talking about is liberty and freedom and government under the control of people instead of the reverse.
Of the people, by the people, for the people. And this is so heartening to see.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much longer it will be, probably after Super Tuesday, that Ron Paul will have to make the obvious decision, and hopefully he's already made it in his heart of hearts, that he will run as an independent, because they're not going to give him the Republican nomination.
Yeah.
And as an independent, he will continue to, if nothing else, enliven, enrich, entice, and entrance our young people, many of them, to come into a corrupt and rotten process, holding forth the highest ideals upon which this, our country, was founded. That is a victory by any measure.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm astonished that people in New Hampshire, I can speak about that only, of course, but they seem to have favored John McCain, if we can believe the voting.
Well, that's the other issue, of course.
People would favor what John McCain has to say, whatever it is. I'm not sure what it is.
Well, me neither.
Over what Ron Paul has been saying.
Oh, listen, let me say one thing. I don't mean to interrupt you. There is no one that I can conceive of who is honestly, reasonably intelligent, who has an honorable grasp of the world in which we currently live, who can vote for any of those scum buckets. Any of them. I don't understand it. I would expect them to abstain from the process rather than support any of these dirtbag professional, gangster, crooked, criminal politicians. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
I pray that what's happening here is that it's a desperation and they honestly think they're doing the best they can. But I fear, Peter, that the bulk of America, the great bulk of America, still is tied, unfortunately, to the mainstream media for news and actually believes that that world they are presented each night electronically is the real world. And these people really are caring and honorable people. I fear that that's the case, and that's the only way I can explain it, beside gross electronic vote fraud, that anybody would vote for these people. I don't understand it.
Yeah. I just completed about a 300-mile trip through eastern Washington over the last roughly 21 hours, and I was heartened to see literally hundreds of Ron Paul signs all over eastern Washington.
How many signs did you see for Obama or Clinton or McCain or
not
Romney? Not there. Thank you. Not one have I seen anywhere. So you ask yourselves, we all ask ourselves, where the hell are these figures coming from?
Yep.
Who are these people that are voting for these morons? No yard signs, no energy, no interest, no nothing. You're right. Everywhere you go, Ron Paul. We obviously have to think, and we know that the past presidential elections have been fixed. We know it's easy to do. I think 50% of New Hampshire was electronic voting. The voter rolls need to be purged everywhere. The system is so rank and rotten, it stinks. But you're right, and wherever you go, folks, all of you listening know, you've seen Ron Paul signs, and many of you probably have them in your yards.
Yeah. I'm just appalled that people would select John McCain. He's been a fairly, I guess, a fairly loyal senator. But the one issue that I would raise with the gentleman is, for example, the Phoenix Lights, a subject that, were it not for your program, Jeff, most people would not know what they are. When we come back, let's talk about John McCain's role in the Phoenix Lights issue of 11 years ago. I think it's significant.
I think it's very significant. I agree completely, and we will do that in just a minute. All right, Peter Davenport and yours truly, Jeff Renz, are with you. Glad you're along tonight. Thanks very much for your time. We have much ahead. Okay, and back with Peter Davenport. All right, Peter, and I want to say one thing, and all of you, I think, who have been longtime listeners know this. Seriously, without Peter Davenport, the Phoenix Lights case, and most especially the O'Hare International Airport case, would never have made the mainstream media, at least to the degree they did in the Phoenix Lights case. And Peter, we pushed that. Peter Davenport, I was so honored to have him on to do that program. He elevated the Phoenix Lights case to where it belongs, which is truly one of the largest and most important significant UFO cases in modern U.S. history, and then single-handedly brought the O'Hare Airport UFO broad daylight case to the attention, literally, of the world, if you play it out from the beginning. And that's not an exaggeration. So without your work, my friend, those two cases, which are the two biggest cases in decades, would not have been known by probably tens, if not hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah.
And that's the truth.
Yeah, I tend to agree. The Phoenix Lights case of 11 years ago, approximately now, probably would have surfaced very, very quickly, because there were other people who are aware of it in Phoenix. There were other people investigating it. Dr. Michael Tanner, Jim Dilatoso, there were others as well.
All too true, and I'm not shorting them for a moment, but the bottom line is you got on that case, and you put together one hell of a program and did much more than that. So
yeah, and I dare say, Jeff, we'll probably be talking about it for many, many years to come, because you're right. It is one of the most dramatic UFO events that I think has ever occurred, probably the most dramatic.
Yeah.
And, you know, a little anecdote on that subject. On the 1st of January, I got a call from a journalist in Southern California. I won't identify the newspaper yet. I'll reserve the right to do so at a later time. I don't know why I protect people who make it their business to bring things out into the open, but it just seems appropriate to do it that way. She called me about these lights that were seen over San Diego on the morning of the 1st of January, and we were talking. She was going to do an article about this. They were exploring the possibility that the lights, which may have been lanterns, I don't know yet, might have been UFOs. And we got into a discussion of UFOs. It turned out that even though she had been in the field of journalism for well over a decade,
uh-huh.
She, first of all, did not know what a contrail is.
Come on.
This is a woman who has worked in journalism for over a decade, maybe approaching two, and she did not know what a contrail is.
Yep, there you go.
The other thing is she had never heard of the Phoenix Lights event. I don't know how this can happen. We look to the press for them to bring us the most pertinent news and bring it to us accurately and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they do anything but that. They do just the opposite.
They seem to be ignorant
of everything going on around them.
They are, yeah. But she could tell you how old Britney Spears' pregnant younger sister is.
Yeah.
These people just are they're looking, the folks are looking, most of them, through little tunnel vision lives and myopically trying to take in the most immediate terrain. They don't understand true research, true investigative journalism. They're just hacks, most of them. That's the bottom line.
That's my impression. And they seem to have their head in the sand.
Well, you're being polite. I'd stick it somewhere else. but it's true. Their egos are literally their guiding light, their forces in life that few can resist. One of them is celebrity. And I tell you, they will do anything and everything they can, in most cases, to preserve their jobs at any cost, prostitute themselves in any way, because they know there are 10,000 people literally standing at their backs waiting to walk across their prone body to take their job.
Yeah. Another example just came to mind as you were saying those pithy words. I think there's a great deal of wisdom in what you say, but isn't it interesting that after Kucinich reveals that he saw something that might have been a UFO, he thought it was, we hear all of this rhetoric in the press, a lot of it mocking, of course, with the cocked eyebrow and the smirk and so on and so forth, but not a single member of the press contacted the National UFO Reporting Center to see what our assessment was of his sighting. It seems to me that they would go to experts to get some kind of background information.
Sorry, you're talking about professional journalism.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore.
That's right.
It's professional entertainment.
Mm-hmm. It's entertainment. I think that says it all.
Infotainment.
Infotainment, exactly.
Okay,
It's astonishing what's going on.
I am so thankful that that we have the audience we do and the people we do who care. This is truly, I believe, the most well-informed and sophisticated, honestly open-minded audience in talk radio. And we like to reflect what we do here on the website and at UFOCenter.com. And again, I challenge all of you who are in the teaching field. I don't care what level you're at. Elementary school, high school, middle. Design a class unit on UFOs. It's only one of the biggest phenomena in the history of this human species. So UFOCenter.com is where you can find the data. Back in a minute. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton won New Hampshire's Democratic primary Tuesday night in a startling upset, defeating Senator Obama and resurrecting her bid for the White House. This is pretty funny. But you think about what is Iowa? It's not even a full-blown primary. And the whole campaign season is supposed to be determined by that? What happened to the long road? What happened to people who hang in there and stay there? And this is, the whole thing is absurd. Iowa and New Hampshire. And the people are trying to extrapolate from that. All right, so we got McCain and Hillary as winners tonight. And Ron Paul, 8%. So.
Very strange. I sometimes think I don't understand the country I live in, Jeff.
It makes three of us.
Yeah. Well, probably a lot of our listeners tonight tuned in to hear stories about UFOs, and here they've gotten an earful of what they're probably sick of, more politics, for heaven's sake.
Well, some of the most unidentified objects on the radar are these imbeciles allegedly representing America. They truly are just hideous.
It's certainly alien to my life. it's crazy what's going on in this country. Everywhere I go, no matter what the venue, people are saying we've got to introduce radical change. We've got to rein in the federal government. So there's one candidate who is saying that, and he gets 8% of the vote.
That's
of the,
right.
I guess, the Republican vote in New Hampshire. But that I don't understand. It's as if people's minds and mouths are they're detached from.
No, they're addled. They're programmed. That's what they call it, programming. They are just enslaved by a system that has been meticulously constructed to do exactly what we're seeing happen here. They just don't really have access to the full spectrum, even half a spectrum of reality. I don't even want to call it news, reality. They live in a world that is largely virtual. It's contrived. It's full of talking heads. It's five or six corporations control 90% and own 90% of the media in this country. What do you expect, folks? That's what you get. This is sad. What was it about this terrible state of affairs that somehow you found surmountable to want to run again for public office and win?
Yeah.
And you have plans to go beyond that. I really admire you for many reasons, but this may be the most amazing feat of strength yet to actually walk into this viper's pit of liars and deceit and try to do something honorable.
Yeah, well, thank you for the compliment. It took me a long time to decide whether this is something I really wanted to do, but I decided that I don't want to spend the rest of my life wondering what would have happened if I had run. It's very important not to just think about doing the right thing. You actually have to do it. And there are many issues here in the state of Washington that need addressing. One we've been talking about it here is I think we have to go back to a system of hard copy ballots.
Have to.
To get away from the electronic ballot machines that it's been shown to my satisfaction that they can be manipulated very, very simply by people who understand that kind of thing. And the voters would never suspect, although I must say I am very suspicious of the results in New Hampshire. You pointed out earlier to me, I think, that the votes in New Hampshire were cast on electronic
50% of the state is supposedly electronic. They ran out of Democrat ballots early today, and the Secretary of State's office was driving all over trying to find extra ballots to rush them to places that were shorted. So, great planning.
Yeah, of course. But I think we have to go back to hard copy ballots, which can be stored and can be counted, can be viewed, et cetera, et cetera. Electronic balloting, I think, we're just asking for trouble there. I think we've had enough, probably enough rigged votes in the history of America to last us for a lifetime. But that's one of the things I would like to do. The other thing I would like to do is press to get the Hanford facility, which we sport up here in the state of Washington, cleaned up. There was just a report that the federal government now estimates that it might run another 20 to 40 years beyond what they had already been predicting it would take to get that facility cleaned up. You know, some of the radioactive nuclides.
40 years.
40 additional years over and above what they had predicted it would take to get Hanford cleaned up. Some of the radioactive radionuclides that are leaching out of the underground tanks are showing up in oysters on the Pacific coast of Washington State.
Okay, now, what you folks are hearing is the truth. We've covered this before. The Columbia River is now the recipient of radioactive waste from Hanford. It's made its way through the groundwater into the Columbia River. That's literal, factual, and true. And I can't even begin to imagine, Peter, how they would go down into the ground and clean and neutralize this horrific catastrophe, which is what it is. And it's only going to get worse.
Yeah. We have 177 underground tanks that have high-level radioactive waste. They contain an estimated 55 million gallons of high-level radioactive waste. These aren't latex gloves that people wear when they handle x-rays in a hospital. This is really hot stuff. Every time they open one of those sealed tanks, I understand they quickly seal it up. They become so frightened and they realize they're going to be unable to handle the contents that the only thing they can do is reseal it.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Well, still nothing to do with radioactive waste from our nuclear power plants, all of which are storing on site, spent fuel rods in basically swimming pool type buildings. They're actually out in the open, I guess, some of them. But they're like indoor swimming pools. They put them in the ground with water, and that's it. They don't know what the hell to do with them.
Yeah.
They want to put them in Yucca Mountain. They still don't know. And from my understanding, it would take an incredible amount of energy and a long time to move all that stuff, truck it, and there will be accidents, of course. Anyway, it's sickening. Be right back with Peter in just a minute. Okay, and we're back. Talking to Peter Davenport, the director of the National UFO Reporting Center. 14 years at it, and his website is a true treasure of information. Human interactions, human events, human beings seeing things that the government says aren't there. Anyway, I just don't know how much longer they can keep this asinine cover-up up. I think, and I do suspect that at some point in time, they, pardon the use of the term, will use it for some kind of geopolitical maneuver or something. I think that's one of the ways they're going to get out of it. They'll use it. I don't know how.
To their advantage, I agree.
Sure, of course.
If they were ever going to tell us the truth, they would have done so by now. I think we're dealing with renegade government and the proper management of this country. And the information that flows to the American people is left now to individuals, not to the government, not to corporate news media, et cetera, et cetera. we're in perilous times as a nature, as a nation, I believe, and we're going to have to do something about it.
If these aren't perilous, I don't want to see perilous.
Yeah.
Let me put it that way. All right, so what's going on? Any good, interesting reports coming in?
In fact, there is. We probably ought to close on the subject of ufology so we don't get any complaints from people who tune in every month for these programs. But I tried to get a commercial pilot on this program tonight, and he declined. He reported a UFO to the FAA in Miami tonight at 0036 hours.
Mm-hmm.
He was flying at about 11,000 feet in a, it's an executive jet, a jet stream, and he saw five lights suddenly appear above him. They were white in nature. He and his co-pilot looked at them for about 5 seconds. They could not identify them. They were above the airliner or above their jet, and he had absolutely no explanation for it. He called the FAA and reported it. I talked to the pilot tonight. He would not come on the program. We may be able to get him for another program sometime, but he was deadly serious about it. The first call we got was from the FAA, a supervisor at the Miami Center tonight, apprising of it, me of this incident. And I'm immensely grateful to those FAA personnel because they contacted the pilot while he was in flight, gave him the telephone number for the National UFO Reporting Center, and we had a conversation after the sighting. But it's very similar to other reports that I have received recently, and which I'm proofreading and hope to have on our website within the next 24 to 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But a great deal going on. Had a very interesting case over San Diego the morning of the 1st of January, which I mentioned earlier in the program. In fact, we're still trying to put the pieces together and decide what it was that people saw over San Diego on New Year's morning. About 30 minutes after midnight on the 1st of January, people saw a cluster of lights floating through the sky of San Diego. And I got many reports. People will see them when I have proofread these and gotten them to our website here in the near future. But don't know what it was. What I've asked people to do is estimate the direction and the angle of elevation to the objects they were looking at, but trying to get people to provide that data, I've learned from experience, is almost impossible. Many people just lose interest after the initial telephone call and move on to other things, so we never see a follow-up report.
Right.
It's unfortunate, but that's what happens.
Right.
So I suspect that the lights were probably Oriental-style lanterns, hot air lanterns that people light during celebrations and release. But you and I have talked about episodes like this, the Tinley Park sightings in Illinois several years ago.
Yeah.
I'll never forget the Carteret, New Jersey cluster of yellow lights that moved across the New Jersey sky, so dramatic that people were stopping on the New Jersey Turnpike and getting out of their cars to look at these objects. People usually rush to judgment and suggest that they're some kind of pyrotechnic device of terrestrial origin. But if they are, I argue, fire marshals should be investigating and pursuing the perpetrators of these events quite aggressively. They're dangerous.
Very much so.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, a great many reports. I've gotten the pulse of very interesting reports from pilots, professionals. The quality of reports over the last 2 weeks or so seems to have increased. I don't know what I can attribute it to. Maybe there's been a recent program or a rerun of the Peter Jennings piece. But
let's hope not.
I hope to have these reports proofread and posted. I know I've been remiss in not updating the website as quickly as I should. I have just been severely overworked over the last year or year and a half, Jeff. And
I know that.
What I'm going to try to do is redesign our website so that all of the reports that come in can be posted on the day that we receive them. So we can just turn them around immediately. But that's going to take it's going to take programming, it's going to take time, it's going to take money to do all of that. And as you know, better than most people, there are a great many things that I'm addressing currently that are very important in my life, and I just can't ignore them. The UFO work has had to take a back seat to much of this. But I'm going to try to turn that around and hope to improve the quality of data we release on our website.
Well, it couldn't get any better, and I'm sure most people understand very well that instantaneous uploading requires some amazing footwork. I have another question, if I might put this out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not slinging stones at anyone, but we have a national organization called the Mutual UFO Network. And there are an awful lot of people working in that organization very hard for no money to try to gather, collate, and present data.
Mm-hmm.
They do put out a magazine, but they're sitting on a huge amount of information.
Yeah.
And it just has a tendency to kind of vanish. It's as if there's no real concerted effort, aside from George Filer, and a lot of his reports are not MUFON reports at all. They're yours and come from Brian Vike. And so where does all this MUFON information go? That's the question. I know it goes into their database, but I've always felt that it's serving a purpose. It's collecting data and what better way for those who want to know what we know to collect and understand all that than by setting up an organization, you know? And I'm not saying that MUFON is necessarily government, but it would be a very smart and shrewd way to operate. You have all the information flow in, very little flows out, it doesn't have to, and you know, and anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You
put yours out there all the time. Brian Vike puts his out with great vigor. George puts his out with great vigor. And nothing from MUFON.
Yeah.
Nothing.
They've got about 5,000 or 6,000 members. I suspect it fluctuates pretty dramatically from what people have told me. But they have a budget of between $300,000 and $400,000 per year. And all of these potential workers and volunteers, I don't understand why we don't see more data coming from them.
I don't
also,
either.
Jeff.
And with that kind of a budget, they could easily set up a national syndicated service for newspapers, and with that kind of a staff. I mean, you're working basically by yourself, like I am, with a webmaster. And but they could, anyway. There's a lot of great information that goes into that organization, and it gets filed, and that's the end of it.
So, and never to be seen again. And oftentimes it sits in boxes apparently for a long time before anybody looks at it, follows up on it, compares it to other reports, and so on. I'm guessing now, because I'm not privy to what goes on in the inner circles of MUFON, but it seems to me, given the resources they have, they could be releasing a great deal more data than what we see coming out of there.
Tons of it. And I say they could set up a national syndicated service for newspapers. They could do all kinds of things. But I never see anything come across my desk from MUFON except George's work, and that's it. And my goodness, the amount of material you put out is awesome. And we credit Brian Vike. There's another one-man operation.
Yeah, he's done a wonderful job.
And think about it. You got, what's their budget, $300,000?
I would say at least, yep.
All right. Maybe we're doing something wrong here. I don't know.
Yep. Well, right. I apologize to our listeners. Next time, next month, I will have information, more information on the UFO phenomenon.
That's always informative to speak with you. And this night we had other things to talk about, too. So.
Yep.
Thank you, my friend. Take care. Okay. Talk to you next time.
Thank you, Jeff. Good night.
Peter Davenport, the director of the National UFO Reporting Center. I'm Jeff Rentz. We're going to pause. We'll come right back. And now we're going to take you all the way across the Atlantic to some place in Europe to talk with the amazing scholar, Michael Tesaria, coming up next. The Atlantic now to somewhere in Europe to welcome back one of the most intense and thorough and aggressive researchers I have ever had the pleasure to have on the program. He's an amazing man. Michael Tesarian is his name. His premise is one that is certainly going to cause a lot of commotion for a long time to come. Briefly summed up, it's the title of his two-volume masterpiece, The Irish Origins of Civilization. Michael has been researching this for a long time. We've talked about this on the program in the past. He was kind enough to send me this two-book set, and it is, I don't know how many pages. We're talking 1,200, 1,500 pages of research here. Just extraordinary work. I don't know how he did it. It's the kind of a thing you'd expect to take someone 5, 6, 7 years to do, or with a staff of 3 or 4 helping him. But he did it, and we're going to hear a little bit about it tonight. So are you there, Michael?
Yes, indeed, Jeff. It's lovely to hear you, and thanks for inviting me on the show again.
Well,
it's always a privilege.
Thank you, sir. And honestly now, how long did this take you? And you can go back to the early years. It doesn't matter. This is the aggregate, truly the cumulative effort of many, many years.
Yes, it is.
Research.
Yeah. Yes, it is. The book actually physically took about 2 years to write. That's what I've been doing for the last 2 years, is just, you're up to like 12-hour days, just to...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just the mechanical aspect of doing this.
They say writing is the loneliest profession.
without my music, I don't think I could have made it. So, it's been... Yeah, and everybody, in my family has been, bugged because I won't spend any time with anybody. Do you get tunnel vision on these kinds of things,
Right. Sure.
Sort of.
Well, what you've got here, you've gotten a hold of something. It's like a golden thread. And knowing you as well as I do, you're not about to turn something like that loose until you get to the end of it.
Well, in fact, even more so, Jeff, it's funny. This, again, was not a planned book. It goes the same thing as was with the Atlantis book. They're not planned. I did not sit down one day and said, okay, this is my big desire is to write either of these books. It's been mostly the support and the insistence of, class members and, friends and people that I do conferences for, mm-hmm. particularly, I can go through the names, but Jordan Maxwell, again, springs to mind. But, there's a lot of different elements where people said, hey, we'll help you with the editing or we'll help you with the various parts of it.
Uh-huh.
You've got to put this knowledge that you do in your talks, you've got to put it down in paper, and... finally, again, just from these people egging me on, sort of realized that the time was right, and also that the world is more receptive now to these ideas. But it was never a personal plan of Michael Tesarian's to, write what you see there.
Well, it's nice of you to mention Jordan. Jordan has been a friend for a long time, and he has he literally, in many ways, created a whole new, I hate to use the word, but I'm going to, paradigm of research and understanding and insight into this world we live in. He's a remarkable man, and that's kind of you to mention him, and we should do that all the time on this program. He's many, many people have, shall we say, spawned careers on the basis of his work.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, and it's so true. We have to get this point across to people that he did open a new genre. You know, he's been so charitable, and he's there for everyone. He was there for me as an Irishman coming to this shores, and, you know, he would stand up and talk about Druidism, and my eyes would just go, my God, this man knows more about my country's ancient history than I do.
It's true.
And he had you know, the books to prove it and the knowledge to prove it when we spoke privately. Mm-hmm. He gave a wonderful testimonial to this new book. And, you know, he was excited when I was 2 years ago when you and I did. In fact, do you realize that your show that I was on 2 years ago is basically in history the first time that this whole subject of the Irish origins of civilization was ever covered? So it's wonderful to be on today because it's like the book is done, and I was so proud to be able to get you on, you know, after you supporting it when there wasn't even a single word written down, you know.
Well, I remember that very well. And this achievement of yours is going to be very hard to dismiss. By the orthodoxy out there, it's there's an old expression about crossing T's and dotting I's, but you've gone beyond that. I mean, you have done something that is so provocative. I kind of can't wait to see how it plays out because, and knowing you as well as I do, you're not going to just publish it and let it sit there. You're going to take this and run with it every way you can, and this will be fascinating.
There's been two. What has happened is more than with the Atlantis book, there's been, you know, a splitting of the ways. For a lot of people, this has been a big yes from a very deep part of their soul.
Huh.
Not just people who are interested in, you know, Irish or Celtic or Druidic subjects. They like it. But not just from them, but from a lot of other people who are into world history. And they understand that there's been an establishment out there that's just been lying to us for so many years. But actually, it's like the other division of people are people who have been threatened, and it's almost like this book, they've been tasered in a way. It's this stunned reaction because, you know, they have to sort of shuffle through their files in order to find a rebuttal, because this book goes to the heart of some of the most, you know, precious lies and fictions that people entertain. It doesn't interfere or intrude into the area of private worship or private belief systems, you see. That's not what this book is about.
It's about establishments,
and it's about the consensus trance that people get in, and it's about really shaking up those types of, you know, perspectives again. So, but again, I didn't put all this energy into it just to let it sit there. You know, it's something that brings a lot of elements together. It's very thought provocative, you know, and it will give insight into how our world comes into being. The world that we see around us is rooted in ancient times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The power structure on the planet today, some people refer to it as Illuminati, globalist, New World Order, certainly World Zionism plays a key role in that. How do you see that really working its way back into your research, and how far does it go? It had to have a point of origin somewhere, the current controllers.
Well, just like Webster, Tarpley, you see, and, you know, Lyndon and so many others have shown, it is an age-old thing. So Americans must never fall for the idea that this is just something that's 200 years old. The enemies of America that are, you know, just busy cutting up America today are just basically lower-level lieutenants for royal dynasties and powerful elites. You know, so Theodore Herzl and James Wiseman and all the people even at the forefront of world Zionism. You know, my work always emphasizes that if you see these people in the media, if you see these people in the history books, they are not the architects of control. You know, they're not the architects of the policies that they maybe work out in the public domain. These are from on high. And it's this coterie that Jordan and myself are always targeting. It's always that, you know, 14th level of the pyramid, because so many other wonderful researchers like Eustace Mullins and G. Edward Griffin, you know, and Bill Cooper and some of them people we love and are my mentors have really gone into great depth in the first generation of American researchers to show, you know, this.
Right.
Show who are the lieutenants. And studying all their work, why would I want to regurgitate what these masters have said, you know? So it's been more my focus to say, okay, then who can we maybe get a small profile, you know, a forensic sort of profile of who may be at the top of the pyramid?
Sure.
And when you start looking into this,
Yeah.
You find out that they use the pyramid for a very good reason, because in fact their origins are Egypt. And added to that, to answer your question more specifically, in the last 15 years, as people who read my book will know and who've gone on the website, in the last 15 years, there's been three very, very important authors whose work we must mention. I think we did on the first program, and I'm going to mention them again because
it
goes to the heart of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
One is Ahmed Osman, the other is Ralph Ellis, and the other one is Mustafa Gadala. These are three unrelated writers, but they write on Egypt, and they specifically have focused in on the origin of the 12 tribes of Israel. They've focused in on the whole question of who are the original Zionists, not the political party we understand today,
right,
but where that word comes from, you see, where this whole concept of Israel comes from. It goes back to the Old Testament, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, and the whole idea of that there was a coterie that, by their own words, call themselves the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, these three authors, you see, particularly Ralph Ellis, has done some phenomenal work to show exactly who these people were. And that far from a bunch of, you know, vagabonds lost in Egypt, or let's say a subservient class in Egypt, these people were actually a royal dynasty in Egypt. And that, you know, this veil of lies that we find ourselves in today, the smokescreen, the camouflage, is not just modern. It was existing back then. The writers of the Bible also wanted to hide the true identity of these so-called 12 tribes of Zion or 12 tribes of Israel.
Hmm.
And we know, of course...
Go ahead.
Well, you know, we know that from the works of even great authors like Douglas Reed and others, you see, we know this, that the story goes that the 12 tribes divided into, you know, the 10 tribes of Israel and the two tribes of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
And Osman and Ellis focus much more on the tribe of Judah to show how these people, you know, created what we know today to be the modern Zionism. So it actually goes way back to the 18th dynasty of Egypt is where the roots of these things are. That's what my book looks at.
Wow. I knew it went back. That's even further than I thought. Hold on. Be right back with Michael Tsarian. His books, as usual, have very provocative photographs that bring his words to life even more. This is some amazing writing. Sir Francis Bacon, of course, is a key figure in our history. I'm going to talk a little bit about Mr. Bacon and many other things as we continue in just a couple minutes. Back with Michael Tsarian, who was up very early over there. And just a quick note, Michael, have you been able to spend any time watching this tawdry political campaign season over here? And I only ask because you might have some view from our European cousins that you want to share. I mean, is it as despicable to them as it is to most of us?
Yes, it is. And, of course, people are very concerned as well, you know. What will happen is you'll get a lot of people saying Americans this, Americans that, Americans are stupid, Americans are this, and Americans, you know, what are they doing? And I always contradict them and say, please do not make the mistake of imagining for a moment that what's going on in the corridors of power there represents the mass of the American people. This is part of the media, you know, campaign to make you think this.
Yeah.
And that people, this is, you know, the greatest country in the world that is sinking into the ground. You have to have support for these individuals. You know, they're finding out,
mm-hmm.
maybe there is a curve in which, you know, America is rising out of its adolescence into a state of maturity to understand just how the game of world politics is played.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, my God, people here, you know, generally tend to be very sympathetic about what's going on and really look to America and to Americans, you know, to change, you know, because, you know,
well, if we don't stand up and do it now, it's over. It's real simple.
Yeah.
The time is now.
I see a lot of apathy here, and I see a lot of people looking to America wondering why do the people not stand up against this kind of tyranny as they've historically done before.
There are many reasons, and certainly we could talk about the most vicious, ruthless weapon ever unleashed on humankind, which I call television.
Mm-hmm.
There's fluoride in the water. There's aspartame, both of which sap initiative and make people basically quasi-zombies. The food is poisoned. I mean, these people who are trying to run the show are very smart. And as you made mention, this is all traceable way, way, way back. What we're seeing now is the culmination of a couple of millennia and then some in terms of control and a move to literally take charge of the planet itself. Now, speaking of the British Isles, Great Britain, England, if you folks will, is quite obviously the most suppressed, subjugated, modern Western nation. Now, these English people are being imaged, I think it's over 500 times or 1,000 times a day every time they go out in public. You know what's going on over there. And they're taking it. They're not out in the streets complaining either. So that same question can be turned around and put, what's happened to people? Why are they so submissive? Why are they allowing all of this kind of dominance? And there are many answers to it. But the bottom line is the controllers, the powers that want to absolutely own this planet and turn it into a plantation have used and been using technology like never before in history. It hasn't existed. And they are way ahead of our common understanding of how these kinds of things are being employed. They're very smart people. Not good people, but very smart people. So you watch what's happening in England, and it's frightful.
And when you blend it together with this occult knowledge, and you add to that the technology that you just spoke of, the fluoride, the chemtrails especially,
right.
You know, you also have the, you know, which David Icke has so many times spoken of, is the whole, you know, idea of the sheepdog, the fear, the incremental from the time of childhood, the surveillance. It's almost like a police yourself type of situation, you know, in which, yeah, you do put up the surveillance cameras, you do put people under scanning,
but
you also send a subliminal message to them that you're under control. It's more of the subconscious, psychological, you know, kind of tyranny.
Well said.
Which I always, in my work, refer to as a war on consciousness, because I always make that the dominant thing. We have other permutations of that, and I'm so glad to see that in certain areas of the world, you know, people are waking up to these various permutations of this world tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
Because these characters, as you say, do not call themselves globalists or internationalists for nothing. They have a deep and abiding hatred of America, which they don't see as Americans see American. You know, America, the people who founded America, the people who worked to labor to create the country,
mm-hmm.
these internationalists that sit in the corridors of power don't see it that way. They see it as just another piece on the grand chessboard, a piece that definitely has to be taken off the piece, or at least eviscerated, so that they can gain this world empire.
Precisely.
Which my book and my work tries to show. If they're talking about new world empires and new world orders, it's because it's to replace an old order, an old world system that you don't know anything about, and you know which now I believe the world can handle. Because when you see so much decay and a state of decay, it must dawn on people that these ancient symbols that they're using, and I mean everywhere, even in the corporate media, just like you're saying on television, it's so pervasive.
Yeah.
On children's programming, on children's television, etc.
Oh, they can't start too early, these people.
Yeah, exactly. And we need a very solid sense of history. We need to know about the acts of genocide, for instance, because, my goodness, we have, you know, books. I mean, libraries are literally filled with stories, not stories, but, you know, facts about the witch hunts, and rightly so. We've got, you know, volumes that have been written on the destruction of the Native American Indians. I mean, people never tire talking about that. You know, we got the conquistador situation. We've even got the, and rightfully, the stories about the atrocious crimes of Lenin and Stalin, you know, amongst the white Russians.
Right.
Over in, and so my book basically is adding to that to say, hey, you know, why is it that the greatest destruction of all, the greatest genocide that ever was created, which was that of the Druids and the Scots-Irish peoples, how come that is a mere passing footnote even in the books of people who are writing on the Druids? This is, you know, part of the thing that got my gander up and just said, look, I'm kind of inspired to write this book in one way because, my God, I'm so sick and tired of reading even other books that are supposedly on Ireland, that are supposedly on the Druids. And, you know, they talk about, Roman army arrived, killed off all Druids. Next chapter, please.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, ridiculous. Can we take this out of the, you know, the shadows and talk about one of the first crimes to be laid at the door of this hideous establishment?
It's also a simple fact that as we continue as a mass of humanity to slip into a malaise,
mm-hmm.
I think that's a fair statement, that history, as we allegedly have experienced it, is continually being, you used the word earlier, and it's perfect, eviscerated. rewritten, sanitized, made politically correct, and literally created from whole cloth. And who's to know? It's amazing. Stand by. Michael Tesarian is here. We're talking about his brand new masterpiece, two volumes, The Irish Origins of Civilization. We'll talk about these books and much more in just a few minutes. Okay, back with Michael Tesarian. The Irish Origins of Civilization. Michael's last book, Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, is a classic. And just for your information, if you can find a copy on the net, Amazon, for example, they start at $89. Congratulations. Well, that's quite a compliment.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't distribute through these people, so these are, you know, completely unauthorized copies. I mean, people can, you know, give that a miss. It's ridiculous how these people, you know, go around taking your stuff and then trying to
paperback
profit out of it.
They got three new and used copies, they say, beginning at $89, so, yeah, I don't know.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. All right, I mentioned Mr. Bacon. This guy continues to crop up. In history, and even people who don't understand history have heard of Sir Francis Bacon. What about this guy?
Well, I mean,
how pivotal a man is he, truly?
I think, you know, again, very important. I mean, I'm sort of, myself, I'm kind of, I think these characters are very intriguing, but, you know, Bacon was part of what's known as the Invisible College, which includes such people as the Hellfire Club members you see later on.
The original Hellfire Club, that Benjamin Franklin was in there later on. And
That's right.
Yeah.
And these Kabbalistic, you know, the occult circles, you know.
Hellfire Club, that's a great name. I think they ought to bring it back.
Well, I mean, people need to research this. They can, you know, look online or, you know, come to our work and check it out, because these people then go on to turn up as some of the heads of the British government.
Yes, they do.
You know, and of course, if you take a few centuries back to the 1500s when the pirates, when the British East India Company, you see, and the Dutch, the progenitors of what we later came to know as the Virginia Company and the Hudson Bay Company, very instrumental in the taking of America, you see, and the East India Company, which was raping the East, you know. So Bacon was part of a conglomeration of people that had served these Plantagenets and served the Tudors, you know, people like the Ogilvy family, who are still very much ensconced in power, the Cabot Lodges. You know, we're talking about very, very powerful dynasties like the Stuart dynasty. And although they appear to be rivals on paper, you know, and like all psychopaths, they do, in fact, have battles and wars amongst themselves. But let's not ever forget for a moment that their real enemy is the people of the world. Let's never forget that for a second.
We are the cannon fodder. We are the currency. We mean nothing to them except players on a big game board. Millions, hundreds of millions of us.
Hundreds of millions. And I think what distinguished Bacon and people like him is he had understood that, you know, there's two kinds of war. There's the war with arms and with swords and with oppression and with empire building. But there's also the ideological war. So his work, you know, his work to edit the Bible and to, you know, again, mix match all the different ancient texts that have been put in front of him, his editorial work and these kinds of things,
right.
You know, and possibly even the fact that he may have been the author of the Shakespeare works, another intriguing sideline, you know. So all of that kind of, you know, dabbling in intellectual matters and influencing from behind the scenes the great intellectuals of his day. You see, this amounts to the whole, you know, British system you spoke about earlier, in which the very intelligentsia coming out of the top universities is not really much different in America, but certainly in an English context, because the country is smaller, people are much more hierarchically structured. So those boys at Oxford and Cambridge, you're going to believe everything they say, and if the Royal Society doesn't like it, then you don't like it either, you know, kind of thing. And so being able to break the consensus trance has been far harder in England and Britain than it has been in America, where iconoclasm, you see, to a certain extent, and rebellion and free thought has been much more, you know, supported, you know, in the past. So in England, you do have a lot of consensus trance. And remember, they're going to punish you. It's a very punitive system. If you don't go along with the flow, you know, you're going to lose your job, or you might not even get a job.
It's all predicated on punishment, suffering, and penury.
Yeah.
And that's not for usury either. Now, to go into this what you've created literally is a new way of understanding. Can I call it Western civilization?
Yes, indeed, sure.
All right.
Absolutely.
I don't know how you'd like to start on this, but the Egyptian portions of it and Michael's work are fascinating. His last book, as I mentioned, was involved with Atlantis and ETs and all the rest of it. And I just happened to open the book to one page here. I like to do this with new books. I don't have time to read the whole thing, but I do read pieces. And one of the pages I opened to, Michael, has two photographs on it. And the first one, the caption, you'll know it instantly. The caption reads, "Grave Robbing Rothschild Agents, Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon." What is it?
Carnarvon.
Carnarvon.
Yeah.
It's quite a scene. These people are often almost deified in archaeology, and they shouldn't be, because they were plunderers, is what they were.
Absolutely.
And
go into that story in the book, based on the works of a man. It's my own researches, but it's also tied in very strongly with a brilliant author called Gerald O'Farrell, who wrote a book called The Tutankhamun Deception, who really, you know, goes for the jugular with these, like you say, lionized characters to show that these filthy grave robbers, you know, not only were, you know, basically about 8 years before the announcement of the opening of the tomb of Tutankhamun, who was a famous 18th dynasty pharaoh, they had already, you know, had tunnels dug underneath and had basically looted the whole tomb.
Well, let me take that and just run fast forward with it. Zahi Hawass and the Egyptian Department of Antiquities, and all of those who truly understand what's going on at Giza know full well that that these people have been doing exactly what you just said for decades. They've been tunneling into. They use the latest satellite and aerial technologies to map the Giza Plateau. They have ground-penetrating tomography. They know where the tunnels are. They know where the tombs are. They know what's under the Sphinx. And, folks, they've been there. They're not going to take a chance on opening something and allowing something to be proffered to the world that might upset things a little bit. These people are awful. I don't like them at all.
And exactly, and people who are familiar with my work on the Irish origins will know exactly what they're trying to hide. It's imperative that they hide the pre-dynastic days, where the pre-dynastic ruins and the pre-dynastic mythologies absolutely prove that the Nile was seeded, and basically that the whole culture of Egypt was predicated and based upon Caucasian Westerners from the Northwest, from Scandinavia, from Britain, that the people that we refer to today as the Druids were indistinguishable from the group in Egypt known as the Amenists. You know, like we say the word Amen at the end of a prayer.
Right.
Well, the Amen is actually from the old god Amen. And the Amenists weren't some weird Egyptian, you know, sort of cult over there. The Amenists were basically an indistinguishable group of enlighteners, or, you know, people involved in the mystery tradition who are aware, and they were no different than the people we describe as the Druids of the Northwest. And Zahi Hawass and these characters that you're talking about, they're involved in all sorts of necromantic, you know, escapades, taking the DNA of the pharaohs. They're not just raping the physical loot, but they're hiding about the history. They're messing with the DNA of the dead pharaohs. It's really atrocious what's going on.
And the age, of course, of the great monuments has been corrupted as well. These things are far older. Just reading through the table of contents in Michael's book, Volume 102, The Irish Origins of Civilization, I mean, you could once a week just pick up the book and read one chapter and watch your mind expand. It's extraordinary material. Be right back in just a couple minutes. As I said, Michael's table of contents is quite a tour in and of itself, and I don't know even where to begin with these. Michael, I'm going to ask you if you would pick some of the chapters you'd like us to talk about a little bit, maybe in some kind of progression, maybe not, however you want to do it. I mean, the first one, Truth and Oblivion. It's a great title.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, that the intro is basically, you know, a dedication to truth, a dedication to the source that guides us all, and a reminder to people to take care of understanding their roots, that particularly the Western man, you know, Caucasian man needs to be very, very attentive to his traditions and his past so that
Michael, excuse me. Is there not a war on Caucasian mankind now?
Well, of course, absolutely.
And I don't mean, that's almost a rhetorical statement, obviously, but this is a very important issue. A lot of people understand intuitively that there's something really wrong, but they can't figure it out. But go ahead, please, with what you're saying.
No, I think that what's important is that you can be attacked by an external force, but that force has no power over you if you're, you know, systemically strong within yourself. What has happened over time, and it has been this war on consciousness, it has been a war on traditions and ancient virtues and ancient teachings and ancient traditions, you know, and what we need to do now is to get back in touch with that kind of stuff so that you become so systemically strong. You have strong roots in the earth, roots in your own past, because these ancient dynasties that have been, you know, contaminating the world, they have, you know, a very strong sense of tradition. My goodness, don't we know that by now? So there is an awful onslaught on virtues and values, you see, of Western men, and this is what's going on. And that opening chapter is a dedication to that, to show that, you know, a weak man needs to be stabilized by the handrails that are provided by the government systems or by these federal kinds of institutions. He's gonna willingly go for them because he is so crippled himself spiritually, psychologically, morally, and so on. And we've spoken before on previous shows about that, how that war against consciousness has worked so slowly, so gradually, through the media oracles, through the fear injection, you know, the constant traumatizing of the human psyche, the limbic realm.
Constant.
You know, And the the wrong attitudes are given towards gender, towards sexuality, towards children, towards your race. All of this kind of mind control that's been coming down upon us in the last couple of hundred years, especially in America. So, you know, that chapter very much opens to say this is not just simply a book about some obscure, you know, sort of a aspect of Irish history. This is about the war or the tyranny that is going on in our world right now that has very ancient roots, but whose permutations are in the world that we live now.
And which, again, is being implemented and waged against us with technology that few people really understand. It's very hard to wrap your mind around the dynamics involved, the insidious nature of what these people are able to do. You can start with genetic modification of crops. You can go to aspartame, chemtrails, as Michael mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. You can go to embedded audio and video information. You can go to the idea that the electronic grid, which, of course, feeds into every home, office, building, and structure that has power, can be, of course, augmented, shall we say, with information that will immediately begin to bathe all who are near it. This is all about the most amazing array of control mechanisms that you could ever imagine, folks. And it's all there. It's all on the table. And they're using it. Now, let's just go ahead I'll just mention a couple of these. But you start right off with the pagan origins of the Bible. Now, that, of course, will ruffle feathers, but not so much anymore, because people are beginning to understand now how the whole idea of Christianity has been usurped, corrupted, modified, rewritten, created again out of just baseline materials to serve purposes. So how do you address it in the book?
Well, the fact of the matter is, again, you're so right, that this book is really not for everyone. You know, it's for those people who are sick of the lies. It's for those people who can start to think outside the box. It's not that there's something wrong with, you know, the essential principles of Christianity or indeed of any religion. It's just a matter of saying, what are the physical roots of this religion so that we understand it? Those who want to just blindly go along to believe something, well, you know, this book is certainly not for them. But anyone who wants to look at and understand that ancient Egyptian Atonism, ancient Egyptian Amonism, ancient Irish Druidism, you see, even the Brahmin system from, you know,
Sure.
To Christianity.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And particularly what the book deals with basically is the solar cult. The whole understanding of what solar worship was, both in its positive forms, which is Druidism and Animism,
uh-huh.
and also in its corrupted forms, which is basically Atonism, what I describe as Atonism, based on the worship of the god Aton, which was a form of worship that was created by the famous pharaoh Akhenaten. You see, we talked about Tutankhamun earlier on,
mm-hmm.
And you know the people who robbed his grave, but Tutankhamun technically was the son, you see, is reputed to be
mm-hmm.
the son, or at least a very, very close descendant of Akhenaten.
Mm-hmm.
And these people had a particular kind of worship that Christians need to know about, and this particular kind of Atonism, what it was called, the worship of the sun, the solar cult, a very specific kind of solar worship that was worshipped at places like Heliopolis, you see, and at the Giza Plateau, you know. And so this book goes into the history of Atonism and Christianity to show exactly what the occult roots of this religion are,
mm-hmm.
and also about the fact that, well, Egypt eventually rose up, you see, and exiled or expunged the Atonists from power because they were basically so corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And then my story picks up because it's Ralph Ellis and Mustafa Gadala, these people I was speaking of earlier, Ahmed Osman, who have done a wonderful job, you see, getting into that and really showing the dynamics
mm-hmm.
of
mm-hmm.
the reign of terror that the Atonists reigned. The only thing is that the thing that really distinguishes my work is that 9 times out of 10, the people who write on Atonism or write on Akhenaten tend to lionize him. You know, they've really... think he was the greatest thing, you know.
It's almost a reflex among historians. And,
yeah.
And, yeah.
You know, and he's very much lionized throughout the books. And my book does not take that at all. I'm one of the only people or one of maybe 2 people in the world that takes a totally different view and that tries to show, you know, what I refer to as the dark side of the sun, the worship of what's called the dark side of the sun that Christians would know as Luciferianism. And they're not far wrong there. Luciferianism is a very good word for it when you understand what Lucifer and, you know, the light it really is, and also what the different occult properties of light are. I mean, there's something on the back, I think, of the second book there where it actually says that, hey, isn't it true that these Illuminati and these characters who are using these solar symbols all over the world, you know, they claim to, you know, adore the sun. Well, how would they feel if that light is shone back on them, you know? So I believe mm-hmm. that, you know, this mm-hmm. is the age in which we can turn that light that they claim to love, that they claim to be, you know, using on everybody else.
Right.
Let's turn the light on them and see how they like it when their dirty little secrets are showing up, you know?
Right. Exactly.
They won't like it. That's the fact of the matter.
No, of course not. And they'll fight. I believe that the controllers now are... again, have been around for so long, they consider it not just a birthright, but their genetic right to run the planet.
Absolutely.
And they've written about how they want to reduce the population of the world by 80% and end up with a plantation, just a skeleton of a middle class left to kind of interface
right.
between them and the serf class below. Do you think that that this is going to actually happen, Michael? Are they going to pull
it off? It's already 3/4 done. Whether we talk about a countdown
mm-hmm.
2012 in the next couple of years, you know, or a post-human world, a world in which technology takes over, in which man is now so scared of his own true feelings, his own true emotions, that he's drugged to the eyeballs with pharmaceuticals.
You know, you've just put your finger on another key point. The whole pharmacological anesthetizing of literally
right.
billions of people.
Yes, indeed. And we've been shown this in sci-fi movies and people still don't get it. You know, I mean, how many movies, how many beautiful songs have to be written? How many books have to point this out that teens right now are just, you know, being forcibly drugged so that their instincts and their own inner matrix is completely in confusion and disarray?
Forcibly drugged, exactly correct. We've talked about this many times. I've run too many stories that make me sick.
Mm-hmm.
The system, Boy, I don't want to go out on a limb again, but I always do. And I honestly think in many ways, Michael, and you made the case a moment ago that you think that the whole situation is already very well underway.
Oh, yeah.
I agree with you that we don't have to worry about 2012, folks. They have their own agenda. They do like dates. They do like ceremony, occult ceremony. They like that. But they're going
Absolutely.
To do it, and they're going to profit in the process, like they've done with HIV/AIDS, which didn't work actually fast enough in Africa to depopulate Africa, so they're going to do something else there. But this whole thing about reducing the world population is quite clear. You don't need a document from them, but they're so brazen about it, they've actually put it in papers. I mean, they write about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, John Coleman, Dr. John Coleman, you know, Eustace Mullins, G. Edward Griffin, we've got the evidence. We've got the facts. You know, I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, it's just a matter of seeing it as it is. And while they're doing this, probably one of the most sinister things about it, is that while they're taking and raping you, and while they're taking the best of what you've got and what your forefathers have created, they're going to entertain you to death with all the rubbish that comes over the television and out of Hollywood and out of all of these other media orgs, you know.
It's almost like injecting a dying person with morphine. It's the same kind of thing.
Well, isn't this part of the ritual? Isn't this part of the, you know, we have to have a dictatorship without tears, remember? It's okay if we can bomb and mutilate in the third world or over in Egypt, in the east somewhere. But as far as the Western man is controlled, it's a dictatorship without tears. He's going to enjoy his servitude. He'll be given, you know, chains of iron as opposed to gold. And in fact, if you take those chains away from him, meaning if you try to serve up a dish of truth now and again, they'll want to, you know, guard your eyes out.
They'll want him back. Give us our chains back. We want better to have something that we understand and are comfortable with, even if it's unpleasant, than the unknown. People are so fear-based now. That's how the game was originally mounted, to engender fear of the unknown into people.
That's right. Fear and anxiety.
And here we are. We've got to take a break, but we're sitting, Michael, and you're watching. The world is watching this Bush-Cheney administration and their war to annihilate an entire country and a people and a history in Iraq. 1.2 million people have been summarily executed by this American administration, such as it is. Genocide on a scale, again, throughout the ages, it will live in infamy. And yet nothing is being said about it over here. It's sickening. Be right back. Okay, we're back with Michael Tsarian. His masterpiece is now available, The Irish Origins of Civilization. Don't laugh. This is nothing less than a revision, if you will, of history, pulling it together with a different spin. And I'm using spin in the highest praise here. Michael has gone through millennia, and somehow with his own fierce intellectual and spiritual compass, pulled this material from all sorts of areas and woven it together into a tapestry that is unusual and unique and entertaining and mind-boggling. And again, he's acknowledged some of the masters, including Jordan Maxwell, who have led the way in this endeavor. But it's his own work, and this is extraordinary. How do people get the book now, Michael? What's the easiest way?
I just could go to the website. You can either go to my homepage, michaeltsarian.com, and they'll see a link through, or they can just go directly to Irish Origins of Civilization, and that's with a civilization is with a Z, like it's spelled in America, not with an S, like it is in England. And there's also a lot of free excerpts up there. We have some abstractions from different chapters, chapter 41, chapter 10, I think, you know, Disciples of Horus. A lot of chapters are up there, excerpts, and also the entire appendices of the book. If you look in the back there, you'll see that the appendices is not included in the physical book because then it would have been about 2,000 pages.
Yeah, I figured that.
You know, it's already about 1,100 or whatever. And we have about 550 illustrations in the book, so it's lots of pictures there. We went extra length to do that, but the website has all the appendices are there for free, so you know people can browse that to their heart's content. We've got incredible information there on the Knights Templar, the connection to the Cretan civilization It's just, you know, we've got stuff about the modern-day rape of Tara and this continuing desecration of Ireland. It's not something that just started with the Romans, you see.
Oh, no, and it didn't just happen in the last 30 years like a lot of people. They didn't even think that far back. No, this is a long, long horror story.
And for Americans in particular, you know, I cover Barry Fell's fantastic work where he talks about the mounds and the true ancestors of the Anasazi Indians being Caucasians from the West. You know, as many of the Native Americans have always said, they've always said that they didn't create that stuff and that white foreigners with blue eyes and blonde hair, you know, did it. Oh, how come we don't listen from the horse's mouth? That's because we've got the Smithsonian Institute, and we've got Princeton and Cornell telling people what to believe
How much in priceless material, our birthright material, has the Smithsonian hidden away?
Exactly. You see, this is an unbelievable blasphemy. And then the suppression of teachers like Barry Fell, you see, who come out. They actually tell Barry Fell that when he discovered Irish Ogham in America, you know, carvings, they told him, no, Barry, that all that is Native American Indians who are high on hallucinogenics wrote those.
Of course.
Can you believe it? You know, the suppression of people like Augustus Laplanjean in South America, you know, who discovered the deep connections between America and the Westerners.
Well, step out of line and your career is finished. That's what it boils down to in archaeology.
Absolutely. All across the board. That's why I self-publish. I don't even deal. This book is not now and will never be in bookstores. It will not be on the main distributors, you see. It will be never. It's always at a grassroots level because I personally, just as a personal thing, I despise all sorts of middlemen, but I will not work with these leviathans, you know. And it's up to people to find this knowledge out, you know. I don't push it, you know. As I said, this book is absolutely not for everyone. And
you have never done that, Michael. You have never marketed or hyped yourself or your work in any way. That's one unique thing that I don't come across very often. You just don't do it. You do it for the right reasons. All of
I do it because I love it, because I have a strong, you know, love of humanity. I love Ireland, and I love my own background. I don't love what the Irish people have become or what they've been doing to each other, because they've also bought into this dialectic of Ordo Ab Cael, in order to be slaughtering each other in the name of religion instead of understanding who's the hidden hand that's been causing this dialectic in your country. You know, so, you know, I'm not a person who is going to take one side of the...
Yeah.
Why would I want to take one side or the other in a full conflict, which is the very thing I'm trying to, you know, draw people's attention to? Why would I then, you know, fall into the same pit in Irish politics? So this is what the book is also about, is to try and step above this whole, you know, double-headed eagle matrix of control start to see who is really running things from the top of the pyramid, you know.
Lately, we've seen a lot of, some contentious news stories about, were the Egyptians black Africans or were they something else? You've seen that, and it goes back and forth. Tragically, I'm not putting anybody down, but these are so petty and so beside the point. The game, of course, is to keep people majoring in minors. They're absolutely looking at their toes.
Well, we go into this in the book. We have a chapter there called the Arya, the Aryans, and it's and another chapter called the Disciples of Horus that go into the true origins of Egypt and show that this was absolutely Caucasian people. Their bodies and corpses have been found. But the Aswan Dam was purposely flooded in order to hide these megalithic, burial sites.
They hid so much stuff for that.
Yeah. And that the early gods of the Amonists all had blue eyes. Horus, in fact, his nickname was the god of the blue eyes. The god Anubis's nickname was the Westerner, the god of the West.
Huh.
You know, I mean, we got the evidence in the book that this is stunning. We also have, you know, the deep connections between Ireland and Egypt, fully explained in there too, and many pictures of the Caucasian pharaohs showing exactly how it was that this information has been hidden, you know, about their facial features and so forth and so on, to try and show that there was a worldwide college of Druidism. Druidism is not just localized only to Britain, as the Roman historians tried to allege. It was a worldwide system of colleges.
For our listeners, define, if you would. And again, there are many people listening, Michael, who don't, and there's nothing wrong with this, they just don't understand what Druid and Druidism really is.
It's a good question, and again, I emphasize what you just said. There's a difference between being ignorant and being stupid. The world may be ignorant, and that's wonderful. We all start as ignorant, and we learn. But the stupid person could never get smart, no matter what you put in front of them, you know. And unfortunately, you know, I'm sure you do, and I certainly come up with these kinds of idiocrats every day of the week, you know.
Yes.
You know, but yeah. To answer your question, absolutely. The word druid is very, it's the root, the word dru or druvid is two very important words that it gives rise to. One is the word for door.
Mm-hmm.
So the Gaelic root for the word druid is dwar, which is very close to our word for door. And of course, if people look at the design of Stonehenge and some of the megalithic sites, you can see that some of them even look like portals and doorways.
Mm-hmm.
And the other word that comes from the word druid, the T and D were two words that sounded the same, so they were often interchangeable. So druthen, one of the roots of the word druid is druthen, but it was also pronounced truthen. So our word truth is exactly the same word as the ancient word druid. So the actual word, so the word druid actually means the servant of truth or the man or the men of truth, you see.
The bringer of truth.
The bringer of truth, simple as that. And that doesn't mean, that means that people like yourself, I would consider a druid. People, anyone who is a servant of truth, anyone who brings truth to the, you know, the table and who serves truth is obviously, in my opinion, is an Arya, is a person who is a druid. And the interesting thing is, to clarify this whole concept on the term Aryan, is that the word Ireland, for it was never originally spelt with an I, Ireland. It was A. The word Ireland originally comes from Ari.
I remember we talked about that in the past,
Yeah, from the word Ireland, meaning the land of the Arya or the Aryans. So this was a word, again, to distinguish the noble ones, the people who were, you know, the learned elite. In fact, we still preserve the word today and the word aristocracy. When you say the word aristocracy,
Exactly, of course,
it doesn't apply to the aristocracy who's ruling the world today are hardly enlightened in the same way that the druids were. They're the most undeserving, blood-soaked criminals. But we're just talking etymology here. The word itself preserves the ancient term for the wise, learned elite that once brought light to the world.
That's one of the things that Jordan also does well. He does so much brilliant work in physical symbology, but he also knows roots of words and can trace them back, and you just did that magnificently.
So well, this is what I meant
about
coming across Jordan, is that when I met him, he was just a minefield of this, and it gave me support as a young man coming to Ireland, coming to America out of Ireland. You know, he gave me the sort of, you know, the moral support to go forward with these ideas, you know, and keep working on it.
Sure.
Well, we have words like, you know, when you're called to the bar as a lawyer, that word called to the bar is actually is an abbreviation of the word bard. And the bard, B-A-R-D, was a member of the Druidic order.
Huh.
And in fact, they were legislators. The oldest system of law in the world came from Ireland, you know. We have the word oligarchy, which contains the word O-L-I, Oli. That is another, that was the name of the supreme druid, the Olam, or what they used to call the Olam Fola in Gaelic.
Huh.
So many words that we use in our society today, you know, aristocracy, oligarchy, the bar, you know, come from old Irish roots, you know. And in fact, there's a chapter very close to the chapter on the American Arya, which deals with the work of Barry Fell, is a chapter on the lost language of the world. We go into the whole idea of the history of the lost language.
What a treasure this book is, and it's in two volumes, and you can get it through Michael's website. Back in just a couple minutes, we'll continue our conversation with Michael Tesoria. Michael, when you see things like the Pope on television, those men in those Halloween costumes doing their thing. What goes through your mind on a personal level, and then intellectually and academically, what would you say about the Church of Rome as it relates to your work? It's just kind of an off-the-wall thing that just struck me.
Well, you know, we go into this very deeply. I mean, I'm very influenced by the work of the great Avro Manhattan, and also by, you know, John Phelps and people like, you know, Father Rivera and those who've exposed the whole Jesuit conspiracy. And what goes through my mind is utter loathsome, you know, feelings, especially to think that this is this utterly pagan edifice that's sitting over there in Rome is not only partly responsible for the plagiarization of the great gnosis of the Druids, but is literally also eviscerated the country of Egypt.
They stole it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And they are, to this day, one of the most deadly, evil organisms in the history of life on this planet.
And that's right. And we'll emphasize again that we're talking here about the institution of the Vatican, not necessarily about the religion of Roman Catholicism.
Correct.
People need to make a distinction there.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, you know, Propaganda Due and many of the occult orders that the Vatican has also spawned, you see. So people need to understand there's a big difference there. But, yeah, the fact that there's 21 obelisks standing on the planet Earth, but 13 of them are in Rome and only 5 in Egypt, doesn't that tell people something strange? Or that many of the popes had their private apartments decorated with the Egyptian gods and all sorts of Egyptian artifacts, and yet they're meant to be, you know, technically Christian. I mean, we got some major questions here about the role of this institution in worldly affairs.
Do we have a chance to really grab hold of the truth, of the essence, of the importance, of the true monumentally astounding thing that we call ancient Egypt? Are we going to be allowed this?
Yeah.
I mean, you've done it in your book, but I mean, you know, we've got people out here who are fascinated with Egypt, and they just don't get it.
Well,
it's not their fault. It's not their fault.
It's not their fault. It's, you know, and it's all, I felt honor bound to, you know, I've researched these things all my life. I was, as I say, you know, very, very, very inspired because I had so many questions. You see, one of the reasons why this book couldn't have been written in the 80s or the 90s is that simply many of my questions had not been answered.
Oh, yeah.
And it took in the last 15 years with the authors that I mentioned, you see, for some of these absolutely thunderous revelations to be made. It's not that these authors, you know, themselves are ultimately that unique. Their work rests on the great mavericks like Emanuel Velikovsky and, you know, Commons Beaumont.
Good
and even
for you.
Sigmund,
yeah.
Yeah, and even Sigmund Freud and Anna Wilkes and Conor McDarry, and certainly my favorite, Commons Beaumont. These are the people that my book is dedicated to. But you see, they rescripted it in a modern context for modern authors to really shine light onto the conspiracy that has surrounded Egypt, especially this whole idea of the so-called African origins of Egypt, which is utter nonsense, you know. That's not to say that there wasn't some, you know, black dynasties of Egypt. Certainly there were in the early days. But to try and say that the entire civilization of Egypt, you know...
How about the civilization of the world,
right,
supposedly ensconced in deepest, darkest Africa?
It is nonsense. I mean, it's patently nonsensical. And the people who pervade this were funded by United Nations. You know, we have the proof of this. They didn't serve Africa. You know, they didn't serve the African cause any more than they served any other cause. They served their own cause, and they served the cause of the globalists. There's not a single ounce of, you know, any academic credibility for what they have said. And my work totally exposes all of that nonsense, you know. But, you know, again, nonsense sells, you know.
Well, especially when the sellers of the nonsense own the markets. And that's pretty much it. They can do it.
They own the market.
It's
absolutely
so hard. It's so hard. And honestly, if let's just say that you folks listening, a couple of you out there, maybe even more than a couple, have a little time on your hands, and you really want to take a trip that will help you put your mind into the entire cosmology of this planet. You could do no better than reading The Irish Origins of Civilization. This is, and as much as I've been able to read of it, which isn't a whole lot, just time, I don't have it, but I would love to sit down and just spend time and walk through this journey that Michael takes people on. I mean, it's stunning. His kind and proper acknowledgement of some of the great men who have written books on this in earlier times and have certainly inspired him is to be is to be acknowledged, and he's done so. But more than that, he's taken it all to a different level. He's gone to a level that I think all of them would be very proud of. And I don't know if any of them had a chance to read your book yet, but two books, actually. But I'd love to hear what Jordan has to say about it someday.
Well, he gave a testimonial. It should be on the back of the book. If it's not, we'll put it on a future one.
Well, I mean, I read that, but I'd like to talk to him on the program about it.
Oh, I understand what you mean. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to do that. You know, I mean, this book is going to stir up a lot of controversy, and I've been
That's
getting
okay.
some very...
You're not stirring up controversy, you're stirring up reality.
Thank you. Agreed. Agreed. Anyway, I have people like yourself to thank, so, you know, I go by that. As I say, you know, my mentors and the people who are in the knowledge, once they have given me, you know, the nod of support, you know, that's really my greatest payment. To me, one of the most important... Remember you were asking about important chapters in the book earlier?
Yeah.
I think the actual chapter on Commons Beaumont, you know, was for me absolutely fundamental. It was a personal sort of triumph, you know, to be able to honor his memory because he was one of the great mavericks that the world has forgotten about.
Wow. Very nice. Very nice. Very, very appropriate, very proper, and very enlightened, too. And I find the cover of the book, your website, of course, is Taroscopes, is fabulous to look at. But the cover of the book... Go ahead.
I direct people more. The new website is MichaelTessarian.com.
That's right. We've got that linked to your name.
Okay.
Or we will have momentarily. It's in the works. But the front cover of this book, I don't know who did the artwork, but...
I did.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time, you know, thinking up of some good cover for the book. It's very important, you know.
Very good. All right, stand by. We'll break and come right back with Michael Tessarian. Michael, how grim is the contemporary Bible?
Well, it's been changed so many times. You know, we don't even have to go back to the time of Francis Bacon. Just in recent times, especially with American situation, uh-huh. we've had so many, you know, misinterpretations and changes. And,
right.
you know, mostly it's not what's in the Bible. It's like any book. It's fascinating. People should read it. They should also get to understand what it really is about as opposed to what they've been told it's about by screaming evangelists and other, you know, disinformationalists and Jesuit stooges and Zionist stooges. Who'd love you to never understand what the true differences are between Judaism and Christianity or where they may blend and where they may divide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a student, you know, one must look at these things objectively without emotion and without partisan belief. And then comes forth the really interesting story, you know. And then out of that you might find, you know, gems of wisdom, and you might find also stuff that's just has been used, as we've said, you know, in an occult nature by the controllers of the world.
Sure.
These people serve the dark forces. They are basically Luciferians by their own admittance.
They not only serve the dark, they are the dark forces.
They are the dark force.
Go ahead.
Well, and we've got to realize that they have also manufactured a lot of these religious tropes that have no, you know, true spiritual meaning. They've manufactured it. And more than that, they're mind-controlling people on an emotional, limbic level. So that your own, you know, see, belief systems and people's mm-hmm. own identifications and prejudices are being, you know, used against them. This is the thing that has to be understood. And that will not add up to true knowledge. True knowledge is man's only great defense in this world. Getting back to his roots is his great defense, and at the same time, knowledge about the world that he's living in.
All too true. I have been acutely aware of, for many years, the number of, and you, chapter 11, caught my eye when I first got the books. Forgers, plagiarists, corruptors.
Yeah.
I am being 100% truthful when I tell you I cannot even imagine how much worse it can get than it is now in terms of forgery,
Absolutely.
Theft, intellectual theft, you name it. It's as if no one can do real, honest research anymore. It's all what the polite word for theft is. Derivative research. But it's theft. It's unbelievable.
And, yeah, there's no reverence. There's no great attitude, you know.
No. And furthermore, there's no accountability for anyone.
Well, what can you imagine when people are desperate to, you know, write some rubbish that is going to be on Amazon or is going to be on every bookshelf of the world, you know, and their girlfriend thinks they're bloody wonderful or something like that, you know, and you
Well, absolutely. This goes right back to what I've always said. We are living in a cult, an age of celebrity, and this is the most the single most important thing that people can attain in life is some kind of celebrity. At least that's
right.
What they think.
Yeah.
It's morbid.
To replace all the true virtue that, you know, should have been there in the first place. You know?
Of course. Are we salvageable, Michael Tesorian?
Oh, yeah. I come to America and I hear your show and I talk to people like Jordan and Richard Hoagland and all. Of course we are. We have so many incredibly scintillating, intelligent people out there. We have, you know, Dr. John Coleman. We have, you know, Eustace Mullins. I mean, the list goes on.
Eustace is on coming on tomorrow night again.
I can't believe it. I'll be definitely listening to that show. And
John, John's been a friend of mine for years.
Sure, and G. Edward Griffin, you know. And I mean, they do shoot some of us down, like they did Bill Cooper, you know, the great Bill Cooper.
Right.
But that's the price, you know, I'm willing to pay, you know. There's no way that I'm going to be stopped doing what I do, you know. There's not sticks and stones, and nothing is ever going to stop my work to, you know, bring the truth before humanity as I know it, and continue that process of myself of understanding what is right and what is wrong in this world. And I have a deep and abiding love. You know, Ulster men, Scots, Irish people fought in the War of Independence for America on the American side, and that war was lost ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, America is famous for losing the wars it wins. We have to re-win the War of Independence again, you know.
America is
this time
famous.
America must win.
America is famous for losing the wars it wins.
You know,
and
we now have to re-win that war. And that's what my work, absolutely every part of it, is dedicated to. Because I know who these royal dynasties work for. I know who these Fabian creatures are that, you know, now sit in the halls of power and are happy to bring America to its knees. And, you know, I will do everything in my power to prevent that from taking place. And I don't care if it has to be one person at a time, you know, to awaken to this cause. Then let's do it one person at a time. That's the way it has to be.
Yeah.
Because to answer your question, absolutely, we are going to win. Darkness, by its own definition, cannot win because it's an obscenity to nature. Anything that stands as evil or proclaims itself as such has no future. Only the truth has the future.
Only the truth. I like that. Words to live by, as they say. Do we have anything at this point in time that you want to point to with respect to off-planet intelligence and how it all intertwines with ancient history?
Mm-hmm.
Well, go ahead, please.
Well, that's what the subject of my first book was. And in a way, I kind of had to sketch in that whole story, you know, of a possible alien visitation of
mm-hmm.
the story of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
Before I wrote this one, because, or even you considered doing anything with bringing forward the story.
That was
of
your foundation, I understand. Yeah.
I mean, the books could have been written either way. It's just that one had, I felt, you know, had to put that together because that's the background. And
mm-hmm.
and just as Gerald Graham Hancock or anybody else will swear blind, is that, look, if we don't accept that the story of our, you know, creation and our history is older than history. Historians are laughingly, scandalously telling us that it's merely 7 to 11,000 years old. The Bible, not the Bible, but the these fake pastors have, you know, lied to us and told us that the creation could only be 4,000 years old. I mean, this kind of nonsense. So when we understand that there were civilizations on this planet millennia ago, then we can start asking a few questions about, again, okay, let's lay in some of the facts about what that might have been, who might have looked like. And my book is a sort of a, you know, a window into what that might have looked like.
How many times has this species crawled up out of the muck and then done itself in?
A good point, too, because, you know, the ancient Druids and certainly the Maya and any enlightened people of the world have said, hey, don't worry about creation folding. It's happened many times before.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and even scientists now are starting to muse on this, what they call the, you know, reoccurrence, the, you know, eternal return, that perhaps on a different, you know, cycle we have to relive our, and but God Almighty, I can't see that mankind has too much future. He's coming to the precipice of oblivion right now. These navigators of doom have been, you know, navigating us towards the precipice of oblivion.
Exactly.
And
right.
they want the world for themselves.
Yeah.
We got to understand that they don't plan to, you know, go anywhere. They're
digging their underground bunkers and building amazing redoubts to go and hide in, and they're going to
spread
it out. And the rest of us are all going to be toast. Every ancient civilization, of course, has at its base the story of a catastrophe, if you think about
it. Yes, indeed.
Back in a minute with Michael, I'm going to ask him to give us his view on 2012. We talked about hype and promotion and all that. How much truth is there to it in your view, Michael? Answer this in a minute, if you would, and we'll just broach that subject, which is going to become louder and louder. For me, I think 2008 is going to be challenge enough, but time will tell. Be right back. Going to be a lot of money. In fact, there already is some money being made on 2012. And Michael, just thought I'd get your thoughts on this. How much do we need to be concerned about it? People I know who have studied the Mayans say the calendar is actually, in other words, they've made a case that the calendar was actually misread, and 2008 is actually when the calendar ends, or it begins, whatever, however you want to look at it.
Well, it's hard to say, and you know, there are these different theories. It's always difficult because we're talking about really two things in one. We're talking about zodiac and we're talking about calendar, and the two are not quite the same thing. So again, you know, and then the whole question of, you know, what size are the different houses of the zodiac and so forth and so on. So there's many factors. It's
sure.
Quite difficult. The main thing I always focus on is not so much this, you know, technical stuff. It's more that, look, we're in a cycle, a countdown to extinction. It's, you know, whether that extinction comes at, you know, 2008 or 2012 or 2015, whatever, we are on a countdown.
We are, and it's being manipulated. It's not happening accidentally. This
no.
is
and
this is all being aided and abetted by those who will seek to run the planet as a backyard plantation again. That's what they want.
And the only humans that they'll leave, you know, on the planet are those who are completely anesthetized, as a robotic, you know, mechanized, basically, as one person, you know, we were talking with, artificialized, you know, the whole artificialization, you know, that which is real has become artificial, that which is artificial is now taken as real. And we're in this Walmart generation in which, you know, human values have completely become erased. So, you know, this, I'm a person who understands metaphysically that out of the ashes another phoenix can be born, and that often you do have to, you know, burn down to the carbon in order to recreate the gold or the diamond. So, you know, I don't look at things necessarily pessimistically. It's like my Irish forefathers would say, well, I'm a pessimist about tomorrow, uh-huh. but I'm an optimist about the day after tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
You know? So, but, and I have a great deal of belief that as you approach, you know, it's almost like people who've had any kind of death experience know that at that moment, you know, or during that cycle, there's a tremendous amount of lucidity. So in many ways, I see that this death experience that we're going through, you know, collectively can, in fact, help a lot of people to awaken. You know, and, I mean, 9/11 shook a lot of people up. My question is, did it wake a lot of people up? And maybe, you know, we can decide on the answer to that.
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either, you know.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I'm particularly appalled, you know. I think that I'm very happy about ordinary people. I think ordinary people have done a great deal of asking questions. What really bugs me is that the Hollywood set, you know, and people who are meant to know better have
right.
really, to
right.
you know, there's been a few that have spoken up and so forth and so on. But on the whole, we hear dead sounds from these people who are just so, you know.
A lot of fear in that business. You've got to be careful or you're out of it. Real simple.
Right. And to me, that stinks, you know, that people should have so little guts, you know, to stand up and say what they feel. And to start pointing the finger and asking questions, because it's only with that kind of spirit of rebellion that America is going to be saved from these fiends, you know.
People will look at your work, the Irish origins of civilization, and say, all right, come on, where are all the artifacts? Where are all the relics? Show me the proof. Where's the physical proof in Ireland? And there isn't as much as we'd like, I guess, as you'd like to be there. And there are reasons for that.
Well, you know, that book is, I believe, a jump start to a great subject. I am not the last you know, word on this by any means. I say that in the introduction to the book, that this is merely kickstarting a subject that needs a proverbial, you know, kick in the ass, that the journey will continue. It's one of the other reasons why I put the appendices online, because that appendices, by the way, is collaborative. That's people sending me information from all parts of the world, you know, and that section will continue to expand. So I hope that people, whether they bought the book or not, you know, will continually browse the appendices section because it's expanding. We have information coming from New Zealand about the Caucasian mummies that have been found there now, the red-haired Caucasian mummies that predate the Maori. For years they've been telling us that the Maori have always said, no, we were not the original ancestors here. It was white Caucasians from the West. But did anybody listen to them? Well, no, they didn't.
Well, those have been found in Eastern Russia, too.
Eastern Russia, they've been found in the Tarim Basin in China. They've been found in the deepest, darkest regions of the Nile Valley. They've been found in Africa. They've been found everywhere. But, people are so hesitant to connect the dots about what this means. They can easily accept that there was a worldwide chain of monasteries and churches, you know, throughout the world during the Christian era that nobody has any problem accepting. They can accept that monks wandered throughout the world, you know, on foot, or that the apostles even left the Middle East to travel west to bring the gospel of Jesus Christ. So then tell me what is so then difficult to accept that Druids could have had a worldwide college and could have moved from the west to the east. You know, I mean, it's utterly ridiculous. It's like saying if I walk out the end of my driveway, I can't walk up the street to the left, I can only walk up to the right. I mean, this is the kind of what I'm talking about, stupidity that people have embodied. And this needs to be revised. That is absolutely more evidence, in fact, for a west-to-east migration of the elements of civilization than there is from the opposite. Absolutely, when you see the facts in an objective way, from language, from the history of language, from monument design, and from the fact of the elements of civilization.
What are some of the monument designs that people would like to hear about now that translate to what you're talking about?
Well, particularly one anecdote jumps out, and that is the very fact that Rome, I mean, we know that the center of Vatican Catholicism is centered in Vatican. You know, did anyone know that the Vatican is perfectly aligned to some of the old megalithic sites at Tara and at Newgrange in Ireland? Or to obscure sites in the north of Scotland, you see? Why would, and of course we know that the ancient sites of Ireland predate the erection of the city of Rome on the Seven Hills. So why then would it be that the architects who create the city of Rome are interested in aligning that city of power to these specific monuments in Ireland through the old practice of, you know, geomancy and architecture? Mm-hmm. How come many of these things are aligned to the Great Pyramid, as this research has now been proven? So there's something occult going on before our eyes that needs to be exposed, you know, the importance of the 30 and the 33rd meridian of the earth, for instance. The interesting, like I say, the pre-dynastic ruins that have been found at Saqqara.
33rd meridian.
Yeah.
33rd. Does this tie into masonry at all?
Yes, it does. The latitudes of the earth and the positions of the banks, the positions of the great stately homes, you see, the great universities and institutes. These are all geomantically positioned based on old Druidic lore. The stealing of old Druidic principles that were for the uplift of humanity have now been used to, you know, dumb people down and to empower these institutions, these negative institutions.
Is there a chance that we'll find, excuse me, Michael, anything still in Ireland, secreted away somewhere that may be discovered at some point in time? Or has it all pretty well been erased?
Yeah, there's been a lot of erasure. It's taken me, you know, 30 years to even get to write that, you know, get the information to put in that book that I've amassed slowly.
Right.
So it's not that it's not there, but you have to train your eyes to see it. But my goodness, the rape of Ireland, that's why, you know, this book was written. The genocide of the Druids, the subsequent raping of Ireland, the fact that the Jesuits are ensconced, and I mean both in North and South, don't let the fact that the North is meant to be Protestant fool you. These people don't give a damn about the Protestant-Catholic divide. They are absolutely there to, you know, wield their sorcery and to steal the ancient works. And the book goes into, I have quotes from the 16th century authors who spoke about the campaign, you see, to eradicate the bards, to
That's when it occurred?
Oh, no, it's been, you know, long before that. It's just that it was written down in the 1600s.
I see.
The first true Irish historian, Geoffrey Keating, wrote down in about 1600s, and his book was then finally translated properly in the 1800s. And his book then talks about the campaign, the absolute campaign of Adrian IV, the Pope, and various kings of England, you see, Henry II particularly.
To eradicate what was left. Yeah.
That's right. And also the campaign of William the Conqueror to do the same thing on behalf of the Vatican in the whole of England. He wasn't just a Norman coming from France because he had nothing better to do.
Uh-huh.
He was actually an administrator for the Vatican. He came there to bring, a control, a financial control and a hierarchical control of the whole of Britain to bring it under the control of the Vatican. That's what his job was. And nothing changed later with the Templars. You see, in the Sinclairs and the Menzies,
uh-huh.
and the entire, movement of the Burgundian Templars, the people
uh-huh.
who were behind the First Crusade.
Uh-huh.
You see, so the people who were responsible for the destruction of Ireland are directly related to the Templars of Burgundy. Did you know that? I mean,
no,
directly.
I didn't.
Oh yeah, there's an amazing connection that the actual connections between Ireland, the ancient Irish monks. That the Christianity would understand as the first Christian monks. They're actually called Chaldeism, but we don't want to confuse people with different terms until they're aware of what these mean.
Right.
But the earliest form of Christian teachings in Ireland actually were the teachers of the Templars. The Templars learned what they learned from people like Bernard de Clairvaux and Robert de Molesme, people who had been opening monasteries first in Ireland. So it's Irish monks and teachers that actually inspired, the Templarism that later on would launch the First Crusade and create the great, royal dynasties of France. And that is why today, people in Scotland will know this, of course, that's why you see so many French fleur-de-lis and French symbols on Scottish and British flags, is because these same Templar families, particularly the Menzies and the Sinclairs, but many others, came later through William the Conqueror to take over the houses of Britain. So we're talking about a massive campaign of royal intrigue that basically eradicated the entire Druidic hierarchy and also the original royalty, the old megalithic royalty of Ireland that was responsible for commissioning the building of some of the most incredible astronomically aligned temples. And now in their place sit these demagogues, you see, that we now later know in history as the Plantagenets, the Stuarts, and the Windsors. I mean, here they are. Nothing has changed, man. The status quo is exactly the same. And people need to understand one fundamental fact. I mean, we're talking mostly to an American audience here, so let them be under no doubt about it, that these same dynasties that we're speaking about that are ensconced in Europe and in Britain, who uh-huh. devastated those lands, the Habsburgs, the Hanoverans, the Saxe-Coburgs, the list goes on, the Guelphs, the people that Webster Tarpley has spent his life exposing, these are the people who've hired the lieutenants that are now working for the destruction of America.
And they're doing a hell of a job of it, too.
Sure they are.
I hate to say it. It's not looking real good right now. But where there is light, there is hope, and there's always
Absolutely.
Light. Thank you, Michael. Congratulations again. This is and anyone listening who's honestly, open-mindedly skeptical, I would urge you to get the books and read them. See what this man has accomplished. It's extraordinary. Thank you, Michael. Be well, and I look forward to another conversation with you. Take care.
It's always a pleasure to hear you, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good night.
Good night, sir.
Michael Tesorian. All right, click on his name, go to his website, click on the data below, the title of the book. You can go there and order it right from the guest section at Rents.com. Thanks for being here tonight, and we'll be back in 21 hours. See you then.